something that comes up a lot throughout the whole saga is that this is nominally a secret project, but it's a really poorly kept secret. Interestingly, the newspapers, the Southern newspapers, were really good about keeping stuff secret for the Confederacy. But the project is helmed by three late 30s men who are very proud of what they're doing. They think they're super smart. And so they brag a bit. They kind of humble brag to some papers.
Trying to impress some ladies, probably.
And also the construction of the boat is kind of also out in the open. You could just walk over and see what they're doing. And this happened with all stages, with all of the boats we're going to talk about. And so our next stop is, as I said, Mobile, Alabama, which, funny side note, so we're going to end up in South Carolina eventually, mm-hmm. which is the reason I chose this, being my home state. And there's kind of a funny, like, some funny bickering over who is really the home of the submarine.
Oh, yeah.
And I found this really, funnily salty article from a Mobile website that was like, these things are mostly tested here, and Alabama is the true home of the American submarine.
It's like an evil bizarro version of the Wright brothers. How North Carolina claims like the birth of flight, and Ohio does because it's where they like were from.
So there was a new hitch, though, at Mobile. The investors now had to deal with the Confederate military, which they really hadn't had to do in Louisiana that much. The submarine didn't fit neatly into the Army or Navy, so they kind of talked to both to see who would adopt them. Major General Dabney Murray proved to be a...
It was a good Southern first name. Yeah. Dabney.
Dabney. Major General Dabney Murray helped, became a big help to them. He was about their same age and was likewise pretty gung-ho about this. And he helpfully assigned a guy named Lieutenant William Alexander and his unit to the project. Alexander had a background in engineering, and he became an integral part of the team with his knowledge and experience in his team. He brings a lot of manpower and expertise to the project. And what they come up with this time is called the American Diver. It's pretty similarly shaped to the Pioneer. It's a little bit longer. It's 36 feet long, 4 feet high, with a 3-foot beam.
Yeah, that's not...
4 feet high.
That's not good.
It had two more crew than the Pioneer did. It has a crew of 5. And like the previous boat, navigation and propulsion were pretty big obstacles. McClintock didn't really like the crank-powered propeller, and he fiddled with the idea of putting an electric or a steam engine in this thing. Little is known about his actual designs, but putting a steam engine in a tiny submarine, he wasn't able to make it work, obviously. Especially, like, you had to have a place for the smoke to go.
And that came up when we talked about some of the early, early 20th century submarines, and how that was a big, big step in making them a viable weapon of war, was like, how do we propel these things without...
We need an internal engine.
Yeah, we need something that's not going to fill this thing with steam.
Steam and smoke. Because it's the smoke's the problem. Because what I find endlessly fascinating is that modern Navy ships, like aircraft carriers and submarines, use steam engines. And the only difference is it's using nuclear power mm-hmm. to turn the stuff into steam instead of burning coal or wood, which is kind of wild to me. I think it's cool.
I know when we talked about the Kursk, it was just bizarre. Because like you hear the term nuclear submarine, but like, it's hard to conceptualize it. There's literally like a little nuclear reactor here. Like within like feet of where these people are working.
McClintock was not able to, I keep on wanting to say McClintock. McClintock. McClintock gave up on the idea of the engine. Couldn't make it work. But it still floated and would go with the crankshaft that he did put in it. Yeah, however, it never got faster than 2 miles per hour. For a lot of effort. Because think about it. This thing's a big, heavy iron thing. And it's being turned by you and 4 other guys using your muscles to move it around through water.
Yeah, for just 2 miles an hour, that seems like a lot of work.
The team was ready to demonstrate it to officials. I mentioned earlier how Dabney Murray, the Army guy, was a big help for them. But this being a submarine, they also had to impress his counterpart, who is Admiral Franklin Buchanan, who was a much different kind of person than Murray. Buchanan's a pretty fascinating guy. At this time in 1862, he's 60 years old. He was originally didn't even want, he kind of ended up in the Confederate Navy by mistake, in that he, like a lot of officers in the military at the time, went with whatever side his state went to. And Buchanan was from Maryland, which was a slave state. And so Franklin Buchanan anticipated that they would join the Confederacy. So the war breaks out. The war breaks out and Buchanan resigns his commission. And then Maryland does not end up joining the Confederacy because the Union jumps on it before it can. And so Buchanan tried to rejoin the U.S. Navy and they said no.
That sucks.
Now you fucked up. You have fucked up now. Now you fucked up. 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 Now you have fucked up.
Mr. President, will you please be quiet?
Suck my presidential cup.
Sorry, man.
So
that's like one of the like fuck you, I quit moments, and you like knock over everyone's computer and like say, you know, peace out, and you leave, and then on Monday you didn't get the job you thought you were gonna get.
Do you ever see the episode of Seinfeld where George quits his job and just goes back the next day?
Yes, exactly. This is a perfect George Costanza moment.
And Buchanan didn't jump into the Confederate Navy right away. He spent a few months being pretty bummed, not knowing what to do. However, though, he did cave and join the Confederate Navy. He gained fame commanding the ironclad Virginia.
Oh, okay.
One of the first ironclads used in this war and one of the first ones used in any war, I think, but definitely the first one in this one. Buchanan was mildly wounded in the Battle of Hampton Roads, which meant he missed out on the famous duel between the Monitor and the Virginia, which happened the next day.
Okay.
The one where the two ironclads just shot at each other until they ran out of shells.
with I guess, no real result except for being, like, really, really loud, probably, on the insides of those. And probably really hot, I imagine.
Can't even imagine what it must be like to be in a metal thing when a shell just hits it. Buchanan was also kind of a stick in the mud about certain things. He was an old man compared to the others, and he was suspicious of newfangled gadgets. However, at the same time, he was he recognized the fact that times changed and he might need to accept some of these things. Mm-hmm. He's kind of like the football coach who doesn't like the transfer portal, but knows that he has to use it if he wants to compete.
Nice.
Talking to you, Dabo Sweeney. Actually, he could keep on losing. That's fine. So Buchanan was much harder to impress and much less enthusiastic to the guys. And things didn't help when, during one test, the American diver suddenly sank without warning. The crew did survive, but the boat was lost. And presumably, it's still somewhere on the bottom of Mobile Bay.
Hmm.
It was never found.
Interesting.
And so now we're in the beginning parts of 1863, and the investors are kind of in a predicament now. They've lost two boats, which had together had cost them over $15,000 in old-timey money.
Mm-hmm.
And new investors were needed, and they were found. Huntley, for his part, at this point, for the third boat, he was only able to contribute $400 himself. He himself was kind of broke at this point, just about. Actually, I had this later, but let me put this now. I had to order these points differently. The submarine had cost $15,000. They didn't have money. Huntley himself didn't have much money anymore. And at this point in the story, while this third boat is under construction, Huntley actually kind of disappears for a little bit. He goes a wandering.
Just needs some me time.
Seems that way. He he did write some letters. Like, we do have his whereabouts sometimes. He bounced around between Georgia and Louisiana and Mississippi. He wrote some letters wondering out loud if he should go join the Vicksburg campaign. And this is a guy who's never been in the army or anything in his life. And he's basically having like a midlife crisis, it seems like, almost. Mm-hmm. And considering throwing himself into battle. And also, though, he was probably doing something a lot of planters did at the time, which was stashing away his stuff so it wouldn't get confiscated by either the Union or the Confederacy.
Makes sense.
He and his brother-in-law, Robert Barrow, both did those kind of things. Despite their nominal patriotism, they didn't want to volunteer their stuff.
Of course, yeah. And also makes sense why there wouldn't be like an overwhelming amount of detail as to what he was doing, because you probably aren't going to write that down.
In his absence, new investors were found. Enter Edward Singer and Gus Whitney, and some other guys. Singer and Whitney are the main guys. Edgar Singer was from Ohio.
A lot of Ohioans involved in this story.
But he moved to Texas, which is where he was operating. And he was a torpedo designer. And the group, his little group, had admittedly cool names, like the Singer Submarine Corps. Or alternatively, Singer Secret Service. Gotta admit, those are pretty cool. So the Singer torpedoes were actually really good. And they were used by the CSA starting in 1863. They had successfully sold them to the Confederate government. I think over 40 of the stationary torpedoes were used. Or more than that, but I think 40 damaged or sank ships. He and his partner, Gus Whitney, became investors in the boat. An associate of Whitney's said in a letter to his wife that he and Whitney together had about a 1/5 interest in the boat, having contributed about $3,000. And what they ended up building, they called the Fish Boat. The Fish Boat was 40 feet long, had a 3.5-foot beam, and was 4 feet high.
So like a pencil.
It's very narrow, and I'll go ahead and talk about the appearance of it, too. It actually looks kind of cool, I think. It has kind of a weird shape. It doesn't really look like a submarine. Like, it doesn't look all... It's not as rounded as we would imagine a submarine to be. It has kind of this almost curvature to the sides that reminds me of old-school dreadnought battleships. Downward-sloping armor.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what it looked like. And then with, like... And it kind of narrowed vertically at the ends. Now, this is only 6 feet longer. I'm sorry. It's only 4 feet longer than the 5-man American Diver. But this was meant to have an 8-person crew.
Trying to find an image.
Yeah, you'll probably find the main one, but the painting. The most famous one is this painting of two guys on a dock.
Okay, that one I'm familiar with. So this is, at this point, we're looking at what is basically a picture of what the Hundley's going to look like.
Well, this is actually going to be the Hundley.
Okay, this is the Hundley. Okay.
This is the Hundley, but it's not the Hundley yet.
Okay.
It is the Fish Boat.
I see what we're doing here.
So this is only 4 feet longer than American Diver, but 8 guys are supposed to power this thing. McClintock totally did away with any ideas of putting an engine in it. This was going to go full manual powered. But he was a clever person, and he did install a differential gearbox to amplify the power of the guys so they would get more power from their stroke. The boat featured 2 conning towers with 20-inch wide hatches to get in and out. Me and my wife measured, and...
So that's like less than 2 feet?
That's less than 2 feet. The guys had to get in and out by putting their hands above their heads.
Oh, that's not good.
Squeezing in and out. The 2 towers had little portholes on along the sides. One was at the front, one was at the back. And additionally, there were 12 deadlights along the top of the sub to also let in some ambient light, just a little bit, because there's no lights in this. The only light is coming from a candle or a lantern, which is held up near the front of the boat because the only guy with hands free is going to be the captain, or is. I imagine they might have had a hook for it hanging, but still pretty dark and scary. Much more prone to claustrophobia, actually, than the other 2 boats because of more guys in it.
Right.
However, The design also helped with the balance problem that the Pioneer had. Because of the tight space, the men had to lean forward to crank the shaft, which put their center of gravity more towards the center of the boat and kept it trim the whole time.
Okay.
Additionally, the boat had diving planes, which is the first submarine to feature those, to help control its descent and ascent.
Those like the little like wings type things that help it go up and down, or I guess more of a runner maybe, but cool.
Yeah, they're like basically side rudders for up and down movement.
Submarine specialists just listen to this and just like tearing their hair out. It's like, it's not the same as a rudder, it's different.
Ballast system was a little bit more sophisticated. The way it worked was the captain would be at the front of the submarine and he would tap the guy behind him, and the guy at the very back of the submarine would open seacocks to let water in ballast tanks, which was kind of similar to the last one, but these were a little bit more sophisticated. And likewise, when he was ready to signal, when he was ready to ascend, he would signal the two guys and they would pump out the water with little air pumps and close the seacocks and the boat would rise. It's still kind of bonkers to me that like a 40-foot long hunk of metal was still able to float.
I think about that literally every ship that exists. I think, how does this thing float? It doesn't make any sense.
I kind of have a better understanding of how bigger ships float, but when something gets small, it's basically just solid iron, just about.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not a submarine designer, so. Anywho, this boat ended up being, had much better performance than its predecessors. It conducted a successful test demonstration in Mobile Bay on July 31st, 1863, in front of General Murray, Admiral Buchanan, and other VIPs. So even though the test was a success, Buchanan still didn't really want to mess with this new technology, and so he wrote to his counterpart in Charleston, South Carolina, Flag Officer Randolph Tucker, who gladly accepted the offer of the sub. So he's like, this works, but I don't want to deal with it. I will write to this to my buddy and see if he wants it.
Cool.
Tucker and the Army commander in Charleston, PGT Beauregard, had a better working relationship than Buchanan and Murray had as well.
That's a name that we know, finally.
Yes. Beauregard kind of pops up all over the place in the Civil War. He was at First Manassas / Bull Run and Shiloh. Now he's here in Charleston, overlooking the Army in the Charleston area. So in August 1863, the fish boat is loaded onto a train and shipped to South Carolina. Or speaking of moving submarines, I haven't mentioned the U.S. submarine project this whole time.
Oh, yeah.
The United States did, in fact, have a submarine project. Lincoln was kind of was enthused about it, but not many other people were. But they ended up building one boat called the USS Alligator. The Alligator was built, and then it was getting towed to theater. It was being towed behind a boat, and a storm came up and sank it off North Carolina's Outer Banks. And that was the end of the Alligator.
It was unmanned at the time, I assume, if it was being towed?
Yes, yes, okay. It was towed. It sank. The Georgia's Daily Morning News said, and the headline said, when the news came, another Yanker devil gone home.
I think it's funny imagining, like, Lincoln being interested in the submarine is like the person who's like least physically capable of getting into one of these things. Is
He will never have to get in one in any way, shape, or form. This kind of shows an advantage of the Confederates' internal line of communication and how these early submarines were better used as defensive boats than offensive boats, because to use it offensively, you have to get it from your friendly port to the sea and then come in
right
to your enemy port. If you're using it defensively, you start in the port and you can patrol the port.
I know we covered that in episode one of Lusitania, where like for like a long time, like even up until basically like until Germany has a lot of success using them, like people still see them as like, this is something for harbor defense. This is not, you know, this is not something you're sending out into the ocean to sink ships. It's fascinating how the concept of what the submarine's even for has changed so radically over time.
The Confederates did not have to sail the Hunley to Charleston. They just threw it on a train, and it got there in 2 days. McClintock, Watson, and Whitney arrived in Charleston with the boat, followed shortly by Singer and his people. Beauregard was enthused with the boat, and he issued orders that the team be granted any article they may need for placing the submarine vessel in condition for service. Funny note about Beauregard in the blockade. Chafin notes that Beauregard, who is kind of vain, kind of dandy, he suffered in the from the blockade because he could not get his hair dyed. And he had been dyeing his little cute goatee and mustache and hair this whole time. And now he was forced to go gray.
The blockade really ages a guy.
Poor guy.
For anyone who's never seen a picture of Pierre Beauregard, he is kind of like the stereotypical, like, you know, mid-1800s, like, military academy. You know, he's got his you know, fancy hair and mustache and stuff. And just kind of that idea of, like, I guess you'd call him like a cavalier type of this era. He's certainly an interesting, and like you said, he kind of an omnipresent force almost. You know, he kind of pops up in all phases of the war in the Confederacy.
And he also oversaw the shelling of Fort Sumter as well, actually.
Yeah, like he's there.
Beauregard was also from Louisiana. He was a New Orleans guy, which made him kind of different from a lot of the other officers of the Confederacy. He wasn't Protestant. He was a Catholic. Mm-hmm. He probably never spoke English until he was 12 years old and went to school. What? He grew up speaking French.
You're telling me the guy named Pierre Gustave Toutant Beauregard was from New Orleans?
That's the case. Yeah, he's from near New Orleans, but yeah. But yeah, not New Orleans proper. Yeah, you're right. And McClintock was given actual command of the boat to actually sail it. He took out the boat on sorties, but he never attempted to sink a ship. Everyone, Beauregard and the army, thought he was just being too cautious, which possibly true, but they got sick of waiting on him. So at the end of August 1863, Beauregard had the army confiscate the boat, and he fired McClintock, and he put in a guy called Lieutenant John Payne, who was a sailor from the ironclad CSS Chickara. Earlier, I said I was going to talk about torpedo delivery systems, and I'm going to do that now. So yeah, how was McClintock, or Payne, supposed to sink a boat? We talked about contact torpedoes and what Singer had made. It was called the Singer torpedo. There was basically two ways you could use this on a boat. One of them was to tow the charge behind you, go under the targeted ship, surface on the other side, and then bring the rope and drag it into the ship. Obviously, this is risky. You could get your line stuck in the propeller. The torpedo could drift too close to you and blow up. And the other option was to mount it on a spar, or basically a long pole on the top of the vessel, and just ram it into whatever you wanted to hit.
Neither option sounds super safe.
No.
And yeah, in the article I was reading, it talked about the towing option, and this proved impractical in shallow water, especially when the current was such as to bring the torpedo down upon the towing vessel.
Yeah.
Not great. Well, especially, I guess, because, like, I'm assuming that, like, internally, there's no real way to know, like, exactly where the torpedo is.
No, Natlas without sticking your head up.
Yeah.
I haven't really described this yet, but the way these would run, they would run on the surface for most of the time. Just like submarines, all the way up into the Second World War, actually. Most of their time is spent on the surface, mm-hmm. and they would dive to attack, and later to attack or hide. It's not like today where submarines are basically underneath almost all the time when mm-hmm. they're out. And you could stick your head out, or you can look through the little port lights. This was the port lights on the side of the conning tower before. The commander was meant to stick his head up in this 20-inch open thing with just little windows on either side and look around. which I imagine was extremely claustrophobic, even more than a submarine. It's like stepping up and putting on a diving helmet. Second in command of the fish boat at this point was a guy named Charles Hesker, who was a former Navy, U.S. Navy sailor. The rest of the crew was rounded out by sailors from the CSS Chickara and the Palmetto State. Which brings us finally, well, not finally, finally, but this brings us to August 29th, 1863, which is my birthday, actually. It's also the day this Skynet came to life. I was a kid. Every time I was a kid and my dad or somebody watched Terminator 2 and it started August 29th, 1997. On August 29th, 1863, the Hunley was tied astern of the ship, the Etowah, by a tow line. And it either became entangled in the line or swamped by the Etowah's lake. In any case, water suddenly overtook the conning towers, which were open, and became pouring into the fish boat. And I have a little account here. So Hesker, Lieutenant Payne, and a crewman named William Robertson did manage to survive, to escape the craft and get out. The other five guys drowned. And here's an account from Hesker of what happened. The boat made a dive while the manholes were open and filled rapidly. Payne got out of the forward hole and two others out of the aft hole. Six of us went down with the boat. I had to get out over the bar which connected the fins and through the manhole. This I did by forcing myself through the column of water, which is rapidly filling the boat. So Faith has this thick waterfall coming through it, and he's just got to force his way up and out. And I imagine it's the guys in the middle who were stuck, which has just got to be absolutely, absolutely horrific.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're just cramped in the middle between guys and water's just flooding in.
Even with the porthole open, I imagine it's still pretty dark.
Yeah, especially once water starts coming in and that's blocking out the light. Oh, I didn't even think about that. It's like every time you see something in a movie in a dark place, there's light. And it's hard to imagine. I watched part of In the Heart of the Sea when the kid goes into the whale head.
Right.
And after watching that, I was like, that's really gross. It actually almost made me gag.
That's a pretty gross scene.
But think about that. The scene is lit with so we could see the actor's face. He would have been crawling around in the dark in there.
Just yeah, it's like dark. You're literally guts. Inside the head of another creature.
The smell must have been... So now the fish boat has sunk and killed five people. This gives everyone some pause. It seemed to vindicate McClintock, who had been loud about saying that people not familiar with the boat should not handle it.
Right.
But they don't want this to go to waste, so... The Hunley is still pretty much a solid hunk of metal, so all they got to do is get it back up, and they can put it back to use. There's one thing they got to do first, though. There's five dead guys in it.
Got to get those out.
Yeah, someone's got to go in there and get those out. So for salvage, they hired the civilian diving team of Angus Smith and David Broadfoot. They were hired to recover the wreck and the bodies. They were paid $7,000 for the wreck and $400 for the bodies. And... So because the boat was underwater a few days before it was raised, the bodies were all bloated and huge. And at first they were too big to fit out the hatch. So at first they had to wait for some of the gases in the bodies to kind of subside and get smaller. And even then, they still had to resort to sawing off the arms and legs of each corpse before they can remove them from the boat.
Yeah, like that's the aspects of this that really anytime it comes to like body recovery and removal from these, it's like these are the factors that don't always get detailed. It's like
you don't always think about someone's got to do that.
There's like mechanical obstacles to doing this sometimes.
And it's not like Ocean Gate where the ocean basically just obliterates them and there's no bodies left. It's just soggy, gross bodies.
In a way, more body than there was before, so...
Yes, and you're sawing them with all that entails.
Yeah.
I like to think that someone had to have had a dark sense of humor and stuck an arm out the hatch and was like, hello! At one point, and just handed it out. The bodies were actually still so big that they had to get bigger coffins for them, which required coffins of a size that Payne felt the need to justify them to his superior.
Oh,
God. He wrote, "The amounts is large, but the bodies had been underwater some time and required larger coffins."
Hmm.
The five men were buried at Charleston Seamen's Burial Grounds in Charleston. And after this event, someone re-enters our story. Hundley comes back.
All right.
So he had heard about the fish boat's completion, and he had written some encouraging letters to his buddies in Charleston. And after he hears about the accident, he decides to get himself back involved. And he writes a letter to General Beauregard, which says, "Sir, I am part owner of the torpedo boat, the Hundley. I have been interested in building this description of boat since the beginning of the war, and have furnished the means entirely of building the predecessor of this boat, which was lost in an attempt to blow up a federal vessel off Fort Morgan in Mobile Harbor. I feel a deep interest in its success. I propose if you will place the boat in my hands and furnish a crew, in whole or in part, from Mobile, who are well acquainted with its management, I will make the attempt to destroy a vessel of the enemy as early as practicable." Did you notice something there at the beginning?
Does everyone agree that this is called the Hundley at this point?
No, this is the first time.
I was going to say, that seems like he's making an assumption here that everyone knows what he's talking about.
No, he came up with that name and he just wrote it in a letter.
Oh, yeah.
Love, just shoot your shot, King, you know. So Beauregard gets this letter and he thinks about it. He's already decided to fire Lieutenant Payne. He doesn't like his performance so far. Not only has he failed to sink anybody, he's killed five people with it. And so he decides, sure, I'll bring Hundley on. And so he does. And Hundley does indeed get some guys from Mobile to crew the boat. Now at this point they had heard about what had happened, and he assuages their fears by basically saying those guys didn't know what they were doing because they weren't familiar with the boat. You guys are, you'll be fine. And so they say, okay, we'll be fine. Something to note though, that Hundley wasn't actually the commander of the boat at this time. He was more like the manager. To replace Lieutenant Payne, they get a new commander, a guy named Lieutenant George Dixon. Dixon was from Ohio, probably.
Another one?
Yeah, probably. He was from the Midwest. We actually don't know where he's from. We actually don't know a lot about Dixon. He was working on the river when the war broke out, and he joined the Alabama. He joined an Alabama regiment. Chafin describes him as being kind of a rich dandy, or he seems to have been. He had linen shirts, a foghorn hat, like a diamond brooch thing. He dressed fancy. He was a fancy lad. Hmm. And he had had some experience before in the war. He was actually at the Battle of Shiloh, where he was hit in the leg with a bullet. But a $20 gold piece that he had in his pocket stopped the bullet, stopped it enough to let him live and survive without having to get his leg amputated, which was pretty much what happened if you got shot in an arm or a leg in this period. And so he kept this gold coin for luck with this little bullet dent in it. So he was familiar, and he'd also worked and had been familiar with the work in Mobile, as Hundley had said. Dixon says he had also, apparently, this only came up at this point in the book when I was reading it, but Dixon also apparently had some actual time inside the boat as well, and so was familiar with how to work it. So he takes it, and they start doing sorties / going out, demonstrating, familiarizing with themselves. They developed a daily routine where they would dive under the CSS Indian Chief, and they would go towards it. They would dive underneath it. All the crew on the Indian Chief would watch them run to the other side. It would come up and they would go, "Woo!" And everyone would be happy. And they did this a lot. And
it sounds like fun.
Yeah, sounds like fun. I bet it looked really cool if you'd never seen something go underwater like that and come back up like a machine too. I bet the guys on the boat were just amazed. On October 15th, 1863, Dixon was not available. And we don't exactly know why, but he wasn't. He might have been in Charleston somewhere. He might have been out of town. We don't actually know. But he wasn't available. And so our boy steps up. Hundley takes command and decides he's going to be in the driver's seat this time. And so on October 15th, he takes the boat out with the crew. He goes towards the Indian chief like they had been doing. Boat goes down. The crew waits for it to come back up. And they keep waiting. And they keep waiting. And they keep waiting. And Hundley does not resurface.
Oh, no.
It's gone. What exactly happened, we aren't entirely sure. We think that Hundley might have accidentally flooded the ballast tanks more when he meant to empty them. And by time the Hundley got to the bottom of the harbor, the water pressure above was too much to open the hatches. These guys didn't drown. They asphyxiated to death.
I'll pick your poison, I guess, at this point. Any of these, there was something, and I forget the details of it, related with the kind of the final moments of the people on the Kursk, but any of these stories that kind of end with like what's presumably just someone literally just accidentally doing something is just so like, it's just such a gripping twist to the story of like literally just someone like messed up and game over. So
yeah, just it's horrifying to think about too.
Accidentally hit the ship sink button.
I hit the wrong button. I hit the self-destruct button by mistake.
Why did we install that button?
So obviously this is a pretty major setback. In your episode about the ocean, about Ocean Gate, I think Taylor said that the Hundley might have cared more about safety. Well, ironically, they did, because after this accident, Beauregard and his peeps took a long, hard look, and they were like, I'm not sure about this thing. It doesn't seem safe.
It seems pretty dangerous.
Well, see, last time we had a bunch of quote-unquote amateurs at the wheel. But this time we had a crew of men who were familiar with the sub, including the guy the sub is named after.
Right.
Who claims to have been the designer of it. And Beauregard is feeling apprehensive about using it again. He writes that it seems, 'tis more dangerous to those who use it than the enemy.
The comparisons to the Titan, they seem jokey and frivolous, but like this thing did go through a much more rigorous like testing and inspection process.
Yeah.
Which is to say that it went through one at all. So, I guess.
And when something went wrong, well, we don't know how Stockton Rush would have reacted, I guess, but something goes wrong and they're like, huh, there's an extreme hesitation to put people back in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's now late 1863 when this big project for submarines started. The war was new and fresh and young. The South was doing well. Now the vibes have changed. Things are going kind of differently now. Especially since a few months ago, Charleston itself has been getting shelled by the United States Navy. The U.S. Armed Forces actually attempted to take advance on Charleston through some of the forts, but they weren't really successful. But they still continued shooting cannons at it and reducing the town to rubble little bit by little bit. So Beauregard's feeling a little bit more pressure. A little reluctantly, he decides to salvage the Hundley once again. He calls that same salvage team. The Hundley comes up. The saws go in. The bodies come out. This time, they also add one little advancement to the sub, which is they paint the inside white to better reflect any ambient light through the deadlights and portholes and from the candle on the inside.
A nice improvement.
I bet the guys were glad it wasn't white before they saw the bodies. Because that was probably pretty nasty.
Paint the inside of this, I don't know, roughly flesh-colored, so that the...
It's old blood brown. That's what we call it.
I was going to add on to what you were saying about the kind of the progression of the war and kind of the new context here. In an article I was reading by Robert Schneller from the Naval War College Review, it's called A Littoral Frustration, the Union Navy and the Siege of Charleston. And he kind of adds some context here. He's referring here to Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles, and he says, Welles knew that the North badly needed such a victory. The winter of 1862 to 63 had been the darkest period in the war for the Union. Major General Ambrose Burnside's Fredericksburg campaign had just been added to the list of Union disasters. No progress had been made on the inland waters since the capture of Memphis the previous summer, and the initial operations in Vicksburg had failed. Victory at Charleston in the spring of 1863 would reap vast moral and political dividends.
And there's also kind of a symbolic thing, too, is Charleston is where the war started.
Yeah, as you were saying at the beginning, like you're kind of like stamping it out where it started.
So?
I did also want to add another person that article mentioned was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, the awesomely named Gustavus Vasa Fox. Just a cool name I wanted to throw in.
Amazing name.
So good.
Now, the Hunley's out. It's clean. It's painted white on the inside. And they move its base of operations from Charleston Harbor proper to Mount Pleasant, where it's a little bit more secluded. Nominally, this thing is still supposed to be a secret, but it's not. People had been coming right up to it, and it had basically been operating in public for this time. But they wanted a little bit more privacy, so they moved to Mount Pleasant. That would be the base of operations from this point on. And Dixon, having missed Hunley's accident, was back, and he would spend his days working the boat out, taking his crew. They would go out with the tide, come back in with the tide, look at the squadron, the blockading squadron, noting where ships were, where they would be, plotting where he was going to try to take the Hunley. However, it turned out really difficult to mount any kind of attack. First of all, the ships were kind of far away, like several miles. And that's a lot of cranking the gear shaft to get there. And it's a trip of all night. Like when they would go out and they would be out basically all night and ride the tide back in. So this pattern continued for a few months, all the way up until February 17th, 1864, when George Dixon takes his submarine out in the evening and heads towards the direction of the USS Housatonic. Let's jump to the Housatonic for a second. Blockading duty was really boring, and the Housatonic had been in Charleston for a year and a half. They had settled into a pretty comfortable routine. However, there was some overall feeling of anxiety in the air. This is a good part to mention, which something I haven't yet, which is the David-class torpedo boats. Concurrently with the Hunley, the Confederacy is also building little wooden torpedo boats, which use a little engine and a spar torpedo. One of these, called the David, rammed and sank, or damaged, actually, the USS New Ironsides, an ironclad. This also happened in Charleston. And these were...
That one gets much less... You don't hear that story as much.
No, you don't hear about the Davids a whole lot. And they looked basically just like little wooden submarines, except they were just meant to run. They had really low freeboard, so they'd be hard to see, but they'd run along the surface of the water. And actually, the Hunley would be reported to be one of these David-class boats for a long time, or at least in the immediate aftermath, because those were much more well-known. And so there was a little bit of an extra lookout. Admiral Dahlgren, in charge of the blockading squadron of that area, he had issued orders for extra precautions to be taken, extra lookouts. Steam, 25 pounds of steam were meant to be kept in all ships' engines. He also ordered chain skirts to be used to be lowered around the ships, which you guys talked about this in the Alabama episode, which basically these chain mail for boats.
Awesome.
The Housatonic cannot put its chain skirt on February 17th.
Oh, no.
And then, yes, the extra steam in the engine, like it's weird to look at. And I didn't know this until like I was an adult, because growing up, looking at all the pictures of boats from the Civil War, they're all masted, you know? Mm-hmm. But now we know, or now I know from listening so much of this and learning about boats, basically all big ships from this time were those combo steam mast ships. Mm-hmm. They had the big mast, but they had a little steam engine too.
Right.
So the blockading ships were ordered to keep some extra steam up so they could get moving in a hurry if they needed to. And so around 8:45 on February 17th, it's all quiet on the Housatonic when a man named Robert Fleming notices something weird in the water. Fleming is a black sailor. The U.S. Navy, unlike the Army, was actually integrated at this time. Now, people of color were still given crappy jobs, and it was by no means an equal situation. And we see this here where Fleming sees something weird, and he calls to his officer, "I see something weird. Can you maybe you want to take a look at it?" His officer dismisses it out of hand. It's like, "Nah, you don't see nothing." And he goes to walk away. Fleming is a pretty smart guy, so he calls to his other lookout, who is a white guy, and asks him to take a look. And when his commanding officer sees the other lookout going to look, he's like, "Oh, fine." And he goes with his looking glass to go look. His officer sees what he describes as a porpoise, or what looks like a porpoise surfacing and coming towards the boat. And after watching it, he notices it's not a porpoise. It's some kind of machine. And there's a little light. They could actually see lights from the deadlights or portholes.
Oh, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah, it's kind of spooky. And so they see it coming. They start shooting at it with revolvers and muskets. They try to bring one of the main guns to bear, but the boat is too close at this point. And they also just don't have time to load and fire one of those. So the mysterious object hits the Housatonic and the Housatonic explodes. I'm actually kind of amazed that more people didn't die because it hits the powder magazine, which usually for the boat means the whole thing's gone.
Yeah.
But in this case, the boat is destroyed, but not immediately. And only 5 people lose their lives because of this.
That's amazing, especially because like you said, you've got people sort of lining up to take shots at this thing. So you'd think that with that many people, you know, on deck and close by, this would have a higher casualty rate. But
the guys even said that they didn't see fire or a splash of water. They just saw a column of smoke and wood, which makes it seem a lot less violent than it would be. But I imagine it was still pretty loud and violent. All hell kind of breaks loose at this point. The USS Canandaigua, I had to use the howtopronounce.com for that one, comes to the rescue, rescues the survivors. Like I said, I try not to say only so many people die ever, because that always just sounds weird.
Yeah, I feel like you do have to talk about it in like cases of like best case scenario.
I like to word it like it's something like it's amazing that not more than X people. However, though, they have no idea exactly what the hell just hit them because the craft is gone. It's disappeared and they never see it again. Neither does anybody else who's alive at the time. The Hunley fails to return. And eventually the people on the Confederates realize that it's probably lost. I mean, because that's kind of the end of the story for this part. The Hunley goes out, the Housatonic blows up, the Hunley disappears, and it becomes a mystery as to what happened to it. The war goes on, and I'm trying to find a good transition to this.
I can throw this in. So I know you're going to talk about what probably actually happened to the Hunley, but in this Confederate Submarines article, does talk about, you know, the Hunley never returned to base, and initially some of the thoughts about what may have happened to it between the time that it happened and when it was discovered. Quote, "It was thought to have been so close by when the torpedo exploded that it was sucked into the hole caused by the explosion and carried to the bottom by the Housatonic."
Yeah, one theory was that it got stuck. I remember that now. One theory was it got stuck in the Housatonic, went down with it.
Yeah, and like that was one that I had read about before, but I just like this kind of like cartoonish image of it like blowing a hole and then just like zhoop. Yeah, I don't know if like the underwater physics would support that theory.
So after the war, the Hunley does kind of gain some notoriety or some fame in the immediate aftermath of the war, but interest kind of fades pretty quickly. And by the turn of the century, 1900, no one really remembers it that much. This is when William Alexander. I have been getting William Alexander and William Hamilton from The Whale.
Right.
I've been getting them twisted in my head all week. And I keep on wanting to say Alexander Hamilton as well.
In that episode, because I think at one point you referred to him as Alexander, because like the immediate thing I thought was like, oh, because he's probably thinking of Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah. There's also
this
guy.
It makes total sense to me. Yeah.
There's this, William Alexander. Around 1900, he decided he was one of the guys that Beauregard put on the boat and helped with the engine, helped with the building. And he wrote around 1900, he decided to take up the duty of remembrance. And he wrote fairly decent accounts of what went on. Now, he was writing 40 years after the fact, so some of his details were unfortunately wrong. He got some things mixed up with each other. To add insult to injury, by the time he died in 1914, his obituary said he had worked on the H.L. Huntley as his legacy.
Horace Huntley rolling in his grave that they got his name wrong.
Rolling with no arms and legs.
It's like the only thing you can do, I guess.
I love the arms and legs detail, man.
Yeah, it really
is. That's so funny to me.
It really does add something to the story.
But as the 20th century progresses and submarines become more ubiquitous and used, interest in the Huntley does crop back up and people start looking for it. Now, natural place to be looking would be around where the Housatonic was, right? So when they find the wreck of the Housatonic, they don't find the Huntley. And this is very confusing to people. And there's lots of speculation on why. This also fuels the speculation that the Huntley either escaped or was trying to go in line, like trying to go towards port. There is a very persistent tale that you'll still hear a lot, that Dixon was supposed to shine a blue lamp from to signal the guys on shore, and they would also light a blue lamp to guide him back home, which doesn't really make a lot of sense because this is also fueled because Fleming saw the blue light when he saw the sub. Mm-hmm. And he reported that. This is a very likely of it being George Dixon with a lantern, because it makes no sense after you've just sunk a ship to stand up in your conning tower. Light yourself up when the U.S. Navy is all over the place. What Fleming probably saw was just light from the candle or lantern in the submarine, just kind of reflecting up and out through the portholes.
Right, because it's like at no point it's never very deep.
Yeah, and also the deadlights on the top, I believe, weren't actually known until the wreck was found.
Okay,
and so that adds a little bit more light coming out. But there was still a problem. There's still this problem of there not being a wreck to find, and that persisted all the way until 1995, when an expedition sponsored by Clive Cussler, the novelist.
Novelist.
He's an airport novelist, right? But he's super into submarines and the Huntley in particular. So he sponsors this diving team. In 1995, they find an anomaly about 1,000 feet west of where the Housatonic was. And they go digging and investigate, and lo and behold, it's the Huntley. Now, what was it doing over there? Probably, I'll go ahead and get on what it killed, guys. So we wouldn't know this. So another mystery was, how did the guys die? Did they drown? Did the boat sink and they asphyxiated? Well, what probably happened was they were just too close to a 150-pound bomb when it went off. And they were killed by a blast wave, which was traveled through the water and then through the hull of their boat and ruptured the arteries in their brains pretty instantaneously, probably.
As gruesome as that does sound, I think of the people who were killed by the Hunley, probably the luckiest ones.
That's what I was gonna say. Yeah, they had it the easiest of all the crews. Well, the quickest anyway, versus drowning, or old Hunley himself had the worst luck of them, I think.
Yeah.
Asphyxiating at the bottom.
Yeah, definitely of the various ways to be killed by the Hunley, as a crew member of the Hunley, I think that's the best way.
The crew is killed pretty much instantaneously by the blast, and then this Hunley just kind of drifts more on its westerly course towards out the sea. This is why it hadn't been found. Everyone had been looking on the east side to the port because they assumed that's where it would be going. But instead it just drifted west, hit the seafloor, and the rest of the distance could kind of be attributed to just the ocean floor moving over 150 years. 1,000 feet's not that far over that time. So the Hunley is found. Now a new debate begins. Who gets it? A South Carolina lawmaker is really behind, really pushing for institution to be set up to preserve the Hunley, mm-hmm. and to keep it as like a South Carolina artifact. This is kind of part of our history. We all grew up. It happened in Charleston, like in state history class, we learned about the Hunley. And there's a problem, though, and is that there is already a law saying all Confederate artifacts / material were property of the U.S. government. This was going to go to court, but a compromise was eventually reached. The United States government would own the Hunley, but South Carolina would have custody of it as long as they could take care of it.
So kind of a similar deal to what was worked out with the U.S. and France, with the wreckage of the Alabama, it sounds like, at least broad strokes.
And so with that deal being reached, Cussler released where the Hunley was because he had kept it a secret. But he didn't want scavengers right. to show up. After they found the Hunley, they actually reburied it and hid the coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
Waited till all the legal stuff had got settled. And then in August of the year 2000, the Hunley was raised in Charleston Harbor. Just a few days before the curse sank, actually.
I feel like I remember seeing stuff on TV, like Discovery Channel type stuff when I was a kid, of like raise the Hunley and stuff like that.
I turned 7 in the year 2000, so I was a little not with it.
I only turned 9, I guess.
Yeah, you're only like 2 years older than me.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so now the Hunley is probably the easiest wreck to access of any of the ones talked about because it's on dry land. It's in Mount Pleasant at the Friends of the Hunley. It's the organization that has it, and they have it preserved and in good shape. And I haven't got the chance to visit it yet. I want to.
Maybe Friends is doing a lot of heavy lifting there, but I would certainly yeah. be maybe an acquaintance of the Hunley.
Yeah. But they have a little museum there, and they have the sub, and you can go see it. And
is that like a suburb of Charleston? Is that close by?
Yeah. Yeah. Mount Pleasant is, yeah, it's like a bougie suburb of Charleston. A lot of rich folks live there. When I worked at Tractor Supply, that was like one of the biggest stores in our district. So all the rich people live there. And so that's about it for the actual story, but I have some people to talk about real quick. Oh, I meant to put this earlier, but So for the longest time, the only member of the crew we knew the identity of was George Dixon. And the other 7 guys were a mystery. But after the wreck was recovered, they were able to do some forensics, some DNA evidence, some looking through relatives and stuff. And now we do know the identities of everyone on the boat. Kind of. You'll see what I mean. Which are George Dixon, J.F. Carlson, Arnold Becker, Frank Collins, James Wicks, Joseph Ridgeway, and two guys named Lumpkin and Miller, whose first names have been lost to history. The makeup of the crew is pretty weird as well. Only two of them, Wicks and Collins, were native Southerners. Dixon was from the Midwest, and Ridgeway was from Maryland. And the other four were Europeans. Lumpkin and Miller were probably German. It was Dixon, Collins, so, and then Carlson and Beaker were British. We only really know their names. I'm not really sure how they ended up there. One way they found out pretty early on when they established the European thing, they did that by taking samples from like the bones, and they figured out that half of the crew was fed on corn and the half the crew was fed on rye mostly.
Fascinating.
The corn fed guys were from the Americas, and the Europeans had ate mostly rye and stuff.
That's amazing that they could figure that out.
They are able to find evidence of that in their teeth. And additionally, the other really cool artifact, I think probably the coolest artifact from the wreck, aside from the wreck itself, was they found George Dixon's lucky gold coin with the bullet mark and with an inscription.
I guess it's amazing. And also, like, where would it have gone?
It was like, I think before that, the gold coin had been more of a unconfirmed thing, because we didn't know a lot about Dixon anyway.
Right.
I think people kind of doubted whether that had happened or whether it was true. And so then they find it, and it says he had actually scraped off or smoothed off one side of the coin and had it inscribed with his initials, Shiloh, 1862, my lifesaver. Or my life preserver.
Kind of ironic, given how he died. But yeah, that's amazing to have that small granular level of detail of the story kind of confirmed. That's cool. It reminds me a bit of talking about like the Armada and the shipwrecks and how much they actually are able to find out about the crews of these ships, you know, based on memorabilia that they were known to have had, you know, lockets and brooches and stuff like that. So yeah, always good to have a fun artifact from these. Is that coin in the museum somewhere?
I actually don't know. I'm not sure where it is now. Chafin's book was written in 2008. So I had to look up some stuff because he didn't know some stuff that's happened since then that I've talked about. It's still probably one of the best sources, concise popular history sources on it. But I'm actually not sure where the store is. Lastly, I just wanted to say, some of our characters, what did they do after this? Well, Hunley's dead. His brother-in-law that I talked about earlier, the rich guy who thought the South was going to be financially crippled and him alongside it, well, he turned out to be right. In 1858, he had around $2 million. By the late 1870s, he was declared destitute, and he died of cholera.
That's how it goes at the time, I guess.
I mean, I don't feel bad for him. He owned 700 people, but
that's going to get you a cholera in the karma wheel.
Yeah, you get a bout of that. Interestingly, too, I mean, you cut this bit out because I talked about her. I don't want this to come off as sexist, but treading waters. But reading about Barrow and his wife was Hunley's sister, and reading some of her comments, because he was super anti-secession. But she was super pro succession, which if you've read a lot of letters from like the wives of a lot of these leaders, it's jarring almost how a lot of them were even more gung ho about the cause than the guys. It seemed, I mean, it makes sense. White supremacy has to be held up by everybody.
And I think also it connects not even on the lines of sex or gender, but kind of like you said, you're talking about the wives here of the people who are making these decisions. There's also a level of zeal you can have when you are not the one responsible for the decision. And go, you know, whether or not you have to personally be involved with this, you know, there's a lot to be said about like how zealous can you be about something? You have a lot more leeway when you don't have to actually be the one making the decision.
Also, Barrow and Volumina was Hunley's sister's name. Their marriage, like their marriage, fell apart pretty rapidly after the war, and then she died like 4 years later before he did. And then, as we know, he got cholera and died. James McClintock survived the war, and afterwards, he found himself in Nova Scotia trying to sell the British a submarine. Or trying to convince them to let him build them a submarine.
Anyone involved with this story is probably not going to be a very successful submarine salesman. But I feel like McClintock probably spent the most time in the submarine of anyone who survived. So, like, maybe he is like, well, I actually know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, he could say it's like, if I had been in charge, it wouldn't have sank. Another thing about McClintock after the war is that he really, really, really hated the United States. And he really wanted to become a citizen of Britain. The British guys he was talking to, trying to sell the boat on, commented that in a letter back to London, that McClintock hates his countrymen, Americans, and hopes one day to become a British subject. That wouldn't work out, though. The Brits ended up not buying his sub, and he did not become a British citizen. Instead, he kept on inventing things, all the way up until he was 50. In 1879, McClintock was demonstrating a torpedo, or a mine, in Boston Harbor when it exploded and killed him.
All right.
Which means that both he and Hunley appear on one of my favorite Wikipedia lists, or can. I actually haven't confirmed McClintock's there. When you're reading the Wikipedia of the Hunley, and you get to the sentence where it says, it sank killing Hunley, that's in blue. And you click on that, and it takes you to an article called List of Inventors Killed by Their Own Inventions.
Which, like, for Hunley, is probably giving Hunley a lot more credit than he deserves.
Yeah, right.
As the inventor of this.
Right.
Although, I think credit. People, they need a separate list of just, like, people killed by things with their name on it.
Their name on it. So McClintock dies from his own mine in Boston. In the North, too. We actually don't really know what happened to Baxter Watson, who was one of the original three members. I didn't talk about him a whole lot because there's not really a whole lot about him that we know. But we don't really know what Watson was up to. He tried, after the Hunley sank during the war, to convince the Confederate government to give him money to buy a submarine, or to make us another submarine. Their answer, if they gave any, is not recorded. And he kind of fades from history after that. Singer, the torpedo guy, he continued making inventions and continued doing contract work for the Confederate government, and I think also the U.S. afterwards. And P.G.T. Beauregard spent, after the war, whitewashing his legacy and that of the Confederacy, as well as on two separate occasions in 1866, he was offered the command of the Army of Romania. He turned it down. In 1870, he was offered command of the Army of Egypt. He turned it down, which is just wild to me.
I don't know. Knowing Beauregard, is it like a pride thing of, like, you know, I was a, you know, renowned commander of this, like, you know, wonderful field army, and I got to go to Romania now? Absolutely not. I cannot imagine Beauregard interacting super well with, like, his Egyptian subordinates, I guess. Like, if he was to take the job. Like, I don't know.
I don't know. Like, it's really, because I'm actually not sure. Like, his personality was, I don't want to say more tolerant, but maybe more open. Because a lot of the whitewashing of his legacy does come from the fact that he wasn't as actively terrible as some of the other former Confederate officers. I mean, he was still super racist and did not, you know.
There's always levels.
He wasn't Nathan Bedford Forrest.
You never want to be that.
He wasn't that. I just want to know what Romania was up to. Because Romania, I believe, was independent at this point, right? They were by the Great War.
Are they still, like, partially controlled by the Ottoman Empire, or I don't know. I don't know what they were up to.
1870. Oh, that might have been right around when they were getting independent.
Maybe that's what they wanted him for. It's like,
because, like, oh yeah, Serbia got its freedom in the Balkans, another area that's heating up in the modern world. With the Egyptians, he would have been working with the British. It's easy to imagine how they would have liked him.
Now, there's another good alternate history book is, you know, Beauregard takes command of the Egyptian army. Or Romania.
Beauregard versus the Turks. Or the Serbs, or whoever. That's about all I got for actual Hunley stuff.
Awesome. Excellent story.
Thank you so much for letting me tell it. I was super nervous at the beginning. And
thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for preparing an awesome episode for us here. I think I might split this one into two parts. It'll make two good length episodes once it's edited down, I think.
Give you a week off.
But that's you as Taylor's getting back into the podcast game after all his stuff. But yeah, thank you, Nick, for coming on the show. Again, you know, obviously we had you on for the bonus episode. Thanks for coming on for a main one. This was pretty awesome. Learned a lot of stuff I did not know about a story that I thought I knew fairly well, but a lot of fun new details.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. It's always fun.
All right. And with that, I think we'll sign off and we will be back at some point, with a new main episode for you.